Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this winter we've had it all. Sub-zero temperatures, violent winds, truckloads of snow, copious amounts of ice. It's all been hard on our homes, and this hour, our home improvement expert Bill McAnally is here to help us recover. Hello, Bill.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Well, happy Valentine's Day to you, too. We were going to mark Valentine's Day by talking about the poetry of William Shakespeare, storm on Tuesday made us rearrange things. But you're almost as good as Shakespeare.
Well, he's got a good first name. I don't know if they called him Bill very often, but...
you're almost interchangeable, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's me.
All right, let's talk about this winter. I mean, it's been crazy. We've had the sub-zero temperatures and then the thaws. Going back and forth like that, does that make things worse?
I don't know if it makes things worse so much. You know, materials expand and contract a lot, you know, when we go through these super cold, super warm. But you see the indications of things a little bit more often when it goes back and forth. When I was really young, I can remember looking up into attics with my dad, and we'd look up at the bottom of the roof deck. You know, he'd open a hatch up, and we'd look up there, and it looked like every nail that came through on the shingles, it looked like it had a mothball on it from all of the moisture going up into the attic space, freezing on the nails. And the big reason that we looked up there is because how come we got these wet spots on the ceiling? You know, you'd get cold, you'd get the ice build up in the attic, and then it would melt and drip down into the house. And, you know, we've learned through technology since the early 60s, you know, that we avoid that most of the time. But we still have a lot of houses, in our inventory in Iowa that still run into issues with water dripping down off of all this moisture that's gotten into the attic, condensed on the bottom of the roof, and then it's dripping. Or the big one has been the calls I've been getting is light fixtures and bathroom fans
dripping.
Because they pushed, there might be a leak or something in the light fixture itself or in the ductwork going outwards from the bathroom fan, hopefully to the outside, which it's supposed to be, but there's still people dump them into the attic, and then you really have some issues with a lot of moisture. But it'll freeze and you don't notice anything, you know, when it's 20 below out. But then we've got a 50 degree and then it's raining inside the house. And it was surprising how many people in houses, even from the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, were having issues with water dripping.
Okay, so if you've got water dripping from your light fixture, what do you do, Bill?
Well, you know, that's it. You need to, that's a really an indicator that you're seeing the worst case scenario when it drips. But all during the winter, if you're getting that much moisture in your attic, you probably are getting some condensation up in the attic that long term may take out, you know, your roof sheeting. But if the moisture's going up, it's going through the insulation as it gets to the roof deck, and now your insulation is damp and it doesn't perform as well, so your energy bills aren't as good. So you need to, you know, get up and take a look in the attic and see what is going on. And one of the really cool things, you know, that we have available now is these small infrared thermometers, you know, look like little laser tag guns. You know, you can buy them for $50 now at, you know, at hardware stores and that. You know, go up in the attic and point that thing around and look and see if, look at different temperatures, like of the roof deck in certain places, you know, point and look at the top of the insulation. Sometimes it will show a difference in temperature. But if you just point it in different spots in the bottom of the roof and it changes and all of a sudden it shows it's a little warmer, especially down on the bottom of the slope where it meets the attic space, you know, the insulation. If the roof deck is warmer there, it means there's warmth escaping, you know, from air leaks or not enough insulation in certain spots. And if that's the case, what can happen is that goes up, and let's say it's an air leak carrying moisture. It'll go up to that roof deck, and in certain places it'll melt it, and then when it gets to the overhang, then it refreezes because there's no heat loss on that, you know, whatever overhang you have on the house, and then you end up with a ice dam. We're finding out that most of the time it's lack of insulation or an air leak where there may be a light fixture or a bath fan close to the outside wall that takes warm air up, heats that roof deck up, melts the snow on top, goes to the bottom and refreezes. So that works. And plus, these infrared cameras, when I was at the college, I remember early on, they were about $15,000. Now you can, a couple people go together, FLIR, F-L-I-R, and SEEK, S-E-E-K. They both make plug-in cameras that you can put right into your phone. And the one actually, there's one by FLIR it's $400 now that I was at a conference last week, a couple guys had. And for $400, that does more than what the one that for $15,000 was, 20 years ago. If you had, a couple people go together, it's not that much, and you can easily get it back as you go up in the attic on those cold days. What the camera will do, it will find all those thermal leaks. And a house I built in the 70s, I went up with an early version of an infrared, and it looked like Yellowstone giving off thermals. I mean, you could see every stinking. And I used to show that to students, and they go, well, what idiot did that? And, well, that'd be me, Now at least we have a diagnostic tool.
So, unfortunately, what I'm hearing here, Bill, is that you're telling me that I can't just shake my head and say, what a crazy winter, and move on. I have to follow up on that if my light fixtures are dripping.
Oh, yeah, because, I like those super cold, because then I can really see with my eyeball diagnostics, what's going on air leaks. And I drove by a big chain type motel the other day, and over one apartment there wasn't any snow. I mean, everywhere else was like 6 to 8 inches of snow on the roof. This one didn't have any, and I really wanted to go in and say something, but I thought, well, they just tell me to keep my mind to myself, I guess, my opinion. But I know something's going on, and these moisture issues can cause an awful lot of damage.
Okay, so something else a lot of us have seen with these temperatures, especially during the polar vortex, are frost, not just on the inside of our windows, but some people are finding it on the inside of their walls or creeping up their door jamb, things like that. Now, I mean, that's something that only happens when the weather's extremely cold. Is that concerning?
Well, yeah, but, the thing is, all winter long it's happening. It's just you don't notice it at such a degree. Like I say, I like seeing those, because then you can really, tell people, this is what's going on. Now you see all this ice. There may not have been ice when it was, say, 20 degrees, but by golly, you were still losing a lot of energy, and there's still moisture there. We had a lot of people having – like you say, ice, not just a little bit of water on the bottom of windows, but, a quarter inch of ice going up a foot onto their windows. And I had some people say, well, are my windows bad? No, it has, your window can only do so much. It's most of them are two pieces of glass with a little bit of magic argon gas in between them, and you can't expect a whole lot. The biggest issue with that is we don't have enough, a lot of times enough airflow over the window. Like they call it a window wash of air. So you get warm air to help warm the inner surface of that window up. And by closing your drapes at night, that's usually the worst thing you can do when it's super cold, because you drop the drapes down or close the window off to the inside air. That now you've got some air that's going to start really causing ice and frost. And then what happens when it melts is it falls down and gets behind the drywall sometimes and and wets the insulation. And in worst case scenarios, if people keep doing that, if you have a window that's made out of wood, it's going to trash the window, and warranty sure isn't going to carry it. So, you know, it has to be a window made out of vinyl or fiberglass. So you can keep cleaning that up if you choose to keep dropping your drapes. So a lot of those can be prevented. But, you know, like I say, on the around the doors, I saw a lot of, you know, when you close the door behind you when we were going out when it was this cold, that the bolt, the latch bolt, had so much frost on it, the wooden shut. So people would think they closed the door, and the door was just maybe stuck with a little bit of frost, and the wind would blow it open. So when it gets that cold, you know, flip that handle and make sure that bolt comes out and actually latches your door. It's amazing. I think I'd like to know how many people that really happened to that came home and their door was opening when they came home because of that cold.
Well, I can imagine people also getting frozen out.
Yes. Oh, easily. You know, especially in the 70s, we used a lot of solid steel doors, and in the 80s as well. And those, you know, were just energy hogs. And, you know, you get so much condensation around them, you're right, they would freeze. And, you know, you think the door's shut, but it's actually froze shut when, even though the deadbolt and the latch are open, it's just froze shut. You're right. And same thing with garage doors. They were freezing down to the floor, and then the opener can't pick it up, and the door, the garage door is froze shut.
All right. When it...
Oh, this stuff is just fun. I'm just, you know, that.
and that's something you can just shake your head and move on from?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
It's good
so
building science.
At least there's one of those.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got a number of callers on the line with questions already, and you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bill, we are going to take a short break here in just a moment, but when we get back, we'll talk about ice because there is plenty of that around. Carol from Des Moines will ask her icicle question in just a moment. But I'm sure so many of us, I've seen the most really remarkable icicle formations in the last week.
We'll see, they're pretty. It's artwork, just like Shakespeare.
They are. It was like a frosty wonderland yesterday in the Iowa City area with ice covering every tree and every other surface as well. It was beautiful, but treacherous. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, our home improvement expert Bill McAnally is here today, and we've been talking about some of the trouble this winter has caused in our homes and how to respond to it if you've encountered some of these crises. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's go to Carol on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about icicles that I have in the corner of my house. There is a southern exposure with an eastern exposure, and there's a valley there. It's back tucked in the corner of the house, and there's a big tree on my neighbor's yard just on the other side of the fence. So it gets a lot of protection. I'm concerned about the fact that those icicles are forming there, and I know that there are leaves that collect in that valley, and I don't know if I've cleaned them out or not, but I'm worried about what's going to happen and what's going to the impact of what that means of to have those big icicles.
How old is your house?
Well, my house is actually about 60 years old, but the southern exposure side is a new addition of about 15 years old.
Okay. When you have a valley like that, the hard part about air sealing and insulating those is where the valley ends up, right, you know, as it ends up there in the corner. It was, 16 years ago especially, is we a lot of times didn't leave enough space for insulation. We would cut that valley rafter, and it would just kind of sit on the outside walls, and then you would bring your roof sheeting in, and it sometimes it would only leave maybe 3 inches of space. And if there was any attic ventilation methods put in, you might only have 2 inches of insulation, if any, you know, covering your ceiling at that point. And so what we found is that there's so much heat loss at that point that it's melting everything up in that valley, and it comes down, and then you're getting an ice dam, at that overhang. And on icicles, what's happening, the reason they're forming is because you've got warm water coming down, and then it hits something colder, and then it freezes, and it keeps dripping over itself and continuing until you get, like you say, that huge icicle. And hopefully it's not going to pull. You know, sometimes they get so big they pull the overhangs off the house. I mean, when they get super big. What you can do is look for someone that has ResNet training. What that is Residential Energy Services Network. Someone that has gone through ResNet training is someone that understands how to use blower doors, a lot of infrared cameras. They can come in and do a diagnostic, and a lot of time they can do the diagnostic from the outside, but if not, they'll have to crawl in the attic. And they will be able to help you figure out a scheme to be able to eliminate, you know, that scenario where that water's coming down and refreezing. A lot of times these leaf, gutter covers, they've been blamed for ice dams, and it just, you know, It's not that. It's just that it happens to freeze where they're at the same location. So they're not the cause. It's heat loss from inside. But if you get go ahead.
Well, how would I go about even finding someone with ResNet training?
Well, just get on the internet and you could just Google ResNet Energy Services Network. Or Residential Energy Services Network, or ResNet, and then it will take you to where people in Iowa, it'll have a list of people in Iowa.
Oh, okay.
And then you can get from them. Because since these infrared cameras, they're a great diagnostic tool, but like anything else, they can, you know, they can be abused. So if someone comes in that has a camera, you know, and says, hey, I can do that for you, you need to be trained in it. I mean, there's a lot to it. And so you want to make sure and interview and make sure, okay, how much training do you have? You know, did you do the one over YouTube, you know, or, you know, a 10-minute video that came with the camera? Or did you take, a week-long training or a three-day training on how to actually do diagnostics? And that's why, you know, this ResNet is kind of the bar that you should be looking at, or someone that has a lot of experience in it. But they can do the best thing for you. And some insulation companies have someone that's ResNet trained. There's three or four, you know, probably within, you know, 50 miles of where you're at.
Now, I mentioned before that we've got icicles all over the place. I mean, particularly in southeast Iowa, we had several different ice events in addition to the snow events. I mean, you're just going to have some icicles.
Yes.
It's not always an indicator that there's a problem, right?
No, it isn't. I'm glad you said that, because another thing that happens a lot is we have so many dark shingles, you know, like dark brown or black. Even some developments, you know, say you have to have like a darker shingle or a darker roof. And some darker shingles, when the sun comes out, that heats up the roof, and then, you know, what ice is on there melts, and there it goes down and hits that overhang, which may be in the shade, but it's, you know, that may cause icicles. I actually, on my house, I knew that where part of my roof was located under, you know, huge walnut trees, and I wasn't going to have any heat loss in a certain area, that I was probably going to have some icicles forming because of my dark roof, where it was located, and the pitch of the roof at that particular point. So yeah, you can't just always blame it on, you know, lack of insulation. A lot of times it's the architectural you know, methods that were used on roof structure and angles and where the sun comes out. There's a lot that goes into it. So somebody that understands some building science can usually, you know, figure it out and say, hey, you know, we're fine. You're okay. It's just, you know, something that's going to happen in these events.
All right. And as things melt, it's a good idea to avoid walking under large icicles, right?
Yeah. I can show you some scars from that. Thanks for bringing that up.
Carol, thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We have a question from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org by email. She says, obviously, many factors come into play here, but is there a good rule of thumb regarding the amount of snow on the roof before I need to start worrying about it collapsing?
If, you know, usually the steeper the pitch, you know, it's not an issue. If you have a real shallow pitch, usually the least amount of pitch on homes is a 3 and 12, which that means is for every foot of run or horizontal distance, it goes up 3 inches. So it's a fairly, you know, low slope. A lot of manufactured housing back, you know, if you have a manufactured house that was, you know, from the 70s, 80s or whatever, they had a fairly low slope, and a 412, which was fair, you know, easily walked on. That particular type of roof was very common, and in a lot of cases it still is. Usually if it's built to code, and it's, you know, especially around, you know, towns or cities that have inspections, they have to meet a certain standard to hold our snow load. But when we get a, you know, year where we get several wet snows, or like you say, we get heavy ice and then we get wet snow, that can tax the roof that's there. If it's a steeper pitch, usually don't worry too much about it. But the flatter that it gets, you know, usually if it's hanging there, you know, if it's an older home, you may want to look up in the attic or have, you know, a carpenter or a contractor come over and just take a look and just double check that, you know, if you're feeling bad. Usually you don't want to be dinking around with that because you can get hurt real easy getting up on a roof for one thing. But in some cases, you can buy those snow shovels that have long extensions where you can reach 20 to 24 feet and drag the snow off. You know, that's a good option as well. But don't ever get up on the roof because you think, well, I can walk up there because all the snow is going to hold me. No, because it can let go at a moment, and then you're basically in a mini avalanche, and it'll just take you down. And that's a lot of weight when that lands on you.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We've got a couple of lines open for your question right now. 866-780-9100. Larry is on the line next in Waukee. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Bill. Hey, thanks for sharing your expertise with us. Appreciate that an awful lot.
Thanks.
Question one is, what is the best practice for insulating a wood foundation prior to installing drywall? Question two is, in my attic, I have blown fiberglass. I've noticed over the last 15 years, it's settled by about a third. Can I go back up there with a lawn blower on low speed and fluff that up to restore my R value?
Well, I'll do number two first. What I would do with blown fiberglass is blow a cap of cellulose insulation over the top of the blown fiberglass. It's a little more dense, and, it's in many cases there's a couple studies that they're fairly old, but they're still holding true that, and I'm not bashing any industry, whatever, but it was from Energy Design Update that blown fiberglass, as the temperature drops down, it's somewhat loses its R value or resistance to heat flow. And then cellulose stays the same. And like I say, I'm not bashing any. This is from a study from Energy Design Update. And that's just because, you know, like I say, you can easily fluff that fiberglass back up. And there's a lot of ideas going out there that if you cap that with cellulose, that it will actually help the fiberglass perform a little bit better than what it does. Because it's so open, blown fiberglass is so open, and, you know, air goes through it so fast. You know, and it really, you know, what amazes me, and I'm glad you mentioned this, is, you know, we're so concerned about in walls that insulation is enclosed in the wall cavity. And even the energy code says it has to be completely enclosed. But yet you go in an attic, how's the insulation supposed to work as well with the tops open? You know, it's just common sense. Or so if you kind of put something over the top like 4 inches of sail, it should, as a lot of studies have shown, it should perform better. The other thing, back on the wood foundation, when I was doing wood foundations, we always insulated them on the inside, but then one of my past students, and he's an instructor now, the wood foundations he does, he puts 2 inches of foam on the exterior like we normally might do on a brand new house anyway, and then insulates between the 8-inch deep studs with really any product. The one that seems to be coming around is rock wool. It's a very good product. It's insect resistant. It performs thermally very easy. It cuts easy. It sits in the cavity better. Or blown fiberglass seems to be used in the cavities now too. But the nice thing is you're going to have 8 inches of material in there. But I should have, even on my own house, I did that, so about 20 years ago on the wood foundation. I wish I would have put 2 inches of foam on the exterior because there's a stud every 12 inches, and so I've got all that thermal bridging, solid wood basically to the inside every 12 inches. And I should have put insulation on the outside. So what some fellas are doing, and it seems to be more in Europe and Canada, they're filling the cavity full of insulation if there's no insulation on the outside. They're filling the cavity full of insulation and then putting an inch and a half or 2 inches of polyiso board, usually polyisocyanurate board. It's, usually a foil-faced board on the inside.
Oh.
Does that help?
This insulation is about 25 years old. So... does the ISO also provide a vapor barrier?
Yeah, that's the key, though. Down in a basement, you cannot have a vapor barrier on the inside. So they do make polyiso without the foam or the foil on it, and that's what you want. That wall really needs to be more vapor permeable. It's really strange how the last 10, 15 years, you'd better not have any vapor buried all in the basement. If it's below ground, it's absolutely against building code to do that. There's so many things out there, and foam, spray foams work very good, but they have to be put in right time of year as far as temperature goes. Each product has a temperature range for application, and that's not just air temperature, but material temperature, and if it isn't put in at the right time, it can shrink. And so that's where you really want to get a very respectable contractor on the spray foam.
What would be the best time of year to complete this project?
Summer. I know it's terrible when it's warm, but actually summer. And because especially wood, any foundation, because I got a friend that had an issue with this in this super cold weather, they had open insulation in the basement, so you were looking at fiberglass in between some furring strips on the inside of the foundation, and there was water running down behind the fiberglass because when it's that cold, the foundation gets cold, and then the insulation the insulation keeps that concrete cold, or it's doing its job, but the warm, moist air goes through the fiberglass. It was condensing on the foundation.
All right. Well, Larry, thank you so much for your call. You're going to be okay there, Bill?
Excuse me.
Yep. Hang on. All right. Well, let's do a couple little faster questions here. This one's from Tom in Union. He says, can I use a wallpaper steamer to remove black tar paper from oak hardwood floor without damaging my floor?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't know.
So you want Tom to call
back? I don't think...
and call us?
Yeah, sure. I don't want any extra moisture getting in there. That's what scares me about a wallpaper steamer.
So how would you remove black tar paper from an oak hardwood floor?
I think, well, first thing I would do is I'd get on Pinterest and find out how they're doing it on Pinterest. I'm a big Pinterest person. And it's not just recipes. I keep telling all my friends, what are you doing on Pinterest?
There's party tips, all kinds of
stuff. Oh, there's all that stuff. But, you know, I think the first thing I would try, because I don't want to use any chemicals, because, you know, that's everything's going to stink and it's messy. Get a heat gun and keep it at a low range, because the last thing you want to do is heat it up so hot that it starts to, burn or give off odors. But if you just warm it up just enough to make it let loose, because, there's certain times of year up on a roof where you can pull felt paper off easier when it's warm. But yeah. In some cases, it's easier to take it off when it's really cold. And so I'm running on again, getting way out there. You know, that's something to think about, though. You know, maybe you could even do it when it's super cold, because it'll peel off a little easier.
All right, but you don't think you should take the steamer to the floor.
I know, I wouldn't do the steamer.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send us an email. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here to answer your questions about the home improvement projects in your house or questions about things that seem to be going wrong around the house. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org.
I'm sorry, Charity. I'm
sorry.
You
want to go back to that tar paper?
No. Yeah, I was thinking, hey, you know, we could do some all kinds of little different things. But, I did want to mention, though, sometimes people were trying to save energy, and we have someone maybe do some weatherization or tighten the home up. And in many cases, people will notice, okay, now I've got a lot more moisture on my windows, and I never had any of these problems. When people come in and they want to, tighten things up, there's a whole aspect sometimes that gets overlooked, that when you're, there's an old saying in building science, build tight, ventilate right. When you tighten up a house, that means you have to ventilate the inside more to get rid of excess moisture, fumes, things like that. So when you have someone tighten your home up, you want to ask them, okay, now that we've tightened it, how am I going to have better indoor air quality? Are we going to have improved bathroom vent fans, and how are they going to be controlled? Is my range hood, is that vented to the outside, which it should be, not just recirculating? Where are these fans going? Are they just dumping moisture in the attic, which is going to really make things bad? So there's that aspect that some people, when they do have improvements made, the indoor air quality and the inside actually gets worse. And one other thing I want to mention, when I say if you go up in the attic, if you look up in the attic, and it's especially an older home, say from the 50s on back, if you look up in the attic and the insulation is like a gray and little cubes, and if you shine a light, flashlight on it, and you see some flicker reflections, shut the lid and get back out of it, because it's probably laden. Some of the old insulations had a lot of asbestos in it. And so you do not want to even breathe that. You don't want to stir it up. Just shut the lid and then get a professional.
All right. So make sure that the house can breathe.
Yes. And ventilated correctly. So yeah. Sorry to butt in.
No, that's right good. That's good advice. I mean, we've all been in a car with the windows rolled up. You've got to have some ventilation.
That's right. Just as soon as you're done eating dinner. That's right. Big Valentine's date.
All right. Here is a question from Earl. He says, are you saying that thermal cameras would be best used by ResNet professionals, or can most homeowners use them properly?
Most homeowners can get an idea. Most homeowners, all they want to look for is voids of insulation. If you see a hot spot, if you see heat loss, you can tell just by the colors what it's doing. So I think it's a good investment to do that. Plus, if you're hiring someone to insulate your house, especially when it's super cold, you're on the inside where it's warm, you can go around and check their work. In some cases, that is worth, that's just gold. So yeah, you can, they're very simple to use, but you can get into some real heavy diagnostics with them as well. But most of, you know, the ones that I was talking about, yeah, they're easily for, you know, smaller contractors, homeowners. I mean, I think it's a valuable tool, but, you know, we don't want you going around doing diagnostics in other people's homes. Just, you know, it's a real handy tool like anything else. If used properly, it's good. BPI, Building Performance Institute, is also a place that trains people in building diagnostics. So if they're BPI certified, usually they're pretty well trained as well.
All right. So they're also super fun to use.
Yes,
to use them recreationally, right?
Well, yes, I do. Yeah, yeah. And the other thing is, you never give them to students. You just keep them out of the hands of students. Yeah, if you like tracking your feet, you know, you can walk barefoot someplace, and then you can come back and follow. It's really good if you got kids in the backyard and having a big party. You can keep track of every one of them from your deck.
All right. Here's a question from Bill in Sac City. Our house has low humidity. Is it advisable to add a humidifier to the heating system, or should one use a small one in frequently used rooms?
You know, I'm more of one that if you need to add more humidity, use a smaller one. I don't like the larger ones, only because sometimes people forget to shut them off. Let me give you a worst case scenario. As I was in a house a few years ago, that all of the insulation in the exterior walls was froze. The siding was buckled on the outside because of so much moisture in the walls that the walls were expanding. This was because someone added a whole house humidifier and had it set so much that it was like the inside of the inside of a sauna room, I swear. There was so much humidity, and it went outwards. You know, it goes from more to less. There's less humidity outside, so it went through the walls and froze the insulation. So if you're just going for comfort, you know, if it's just, you know, small times of years, I would use a smaller one. But if you feel more comfortable putting a larger one, you'd better have really good controls, and you don't want to have excess humidity. You know, this time of year, if you're running, 40% or lower, you know, say in the 30s, that's a pretty good health range. American Lung Association really likes that 40 to 43, but it's in some homes, that's a little bit too much in the winter. You know, it just depends on the structure and how tight the home is and how well it's constructed.
Let's go to the phones. Josh is on the line in Blakesburg. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
What's
your question? How you doing?
Good.
All right. I've got a question. I just put in a tankless gas hot water heater, and I need to reroute. I've got a furnace, and before I had the stand-up water heater, which it was the exhaust was tied into the exhaust for the furnace.
Okay.
Well, now the new hot water heater has, you know, it's got that two-piece exhaust with the smaller pipe in the inside.
Right, right.
And what I was wanting to know is, without any issues, can I tie the furnace exhaust into the hot water exhaust?
No. The one from the water heater is strictly a system unto its own. Once it leaves that water heater, you're not to tamper with it at all, you know. And you think, you know, why can't I? Well, there's differences in pressure. There's all kinds of issues, but no, they have to be kept separate.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all I needed to know. Thank you so much, sir.
You bet. Have fun.
Thanks a lot for your call, Josh. Next up, John in Des Moines. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a new garage built this past summer. It's an unheated garage, three stalls. This is the time of year when the vehicles are bringing moisture in, specifically ice coming off the vehicles.
Yep.
The concrete was poured such that all the water runs to the walls, so it's getting into the floor plate. And I'm wondering how big a problem that is. Yeah, I kind of see that as an issue.
Yeah, I do too. You know, it's funny how I remember houses being built where the high spot in the whole floor was this little ridge around the sump pump, you know. The water never got to the sump pump. It is an issue, and one of the reasons it's an issue is if In the last few years, you know, we've been using that, you know, the newer green treated lumber. And yep. when water gets with the newer green treated lumber, which has a copper type preservative in it, and then you use steel or galvanized, you know, attachments or nails, then it really takes that metal. And basically, it's electrolysis. It's like a battery, and it eats those fasteners down like crazy. One I was on, it was a 7-year-old building, and 16-penny nails, you know, it was a good-sized framing nail. They were down to about like a finished nail that you'd use inside because of the moisture that was in that wood. That wood has to be dry because what happens is that wood will, if that bottom plate gets soaked, that moisture will go up into the stud, and now the stud is vertical, so... You know, it's mm-hmm. just like it was when a tree, through capillary reaction, that moisture can climb all the way to the top of that stud. And so now it takes that out. It's a big, big deal. To me, it's a really big deal.
Is my best solution to grind the floor so that it's water's running to the middle?
Well,
how am I going to deal with this? Do I sue the contractor?
Well, you know, I always hate to say that. I always just tell them, well, I know where you live, you know. I come over here and fix this. You don't tell me what to do. You know, in some cases, with the, you know, they can grind it or they can come back and put a topping on it to have it run the other way. But in some cases, too, it's easier to maybe lift the garage up a little bit and then put a course of concrete block underneath it. You know, but or in some cases, you know, you really got to look at it. You may end up having put a drain around the edges to catch that water. But in no way should that be going to the wood. The wood has to stay dry. And there's at least hopefully there's like 6 to 8 inches of space between your siding on the outside to the ground, isn't there?
It's a brick exterior.
Oh, okay.
So brick ledge, brick stacked right on the ledge.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes me even more nervous now because if that wood gets saturated from the water from the slab, then the brick ties or whatever, then the attachments there can become compromised. So I get the contractor back and say, it's supposed to be a flat floor or sloping to a drain or somewhere other than my wet walls. Because they may just grind it down. It just depends. It may not be that much. I mean, if it's only like 3/8 or so, they may grind it. But, yeah, I'd get the contractor back. You know, and a lot of times, you know, just things happen. I'm sure they didn't do it on purpose. So, you know, maybe something slipped, you know, or, you know, a form slipped. So I'd get them back and just have a real, you know, nice, friendly discussion. That's always the best way to handle that.
John, good luck with that. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Brent in Cedar Falls. Hi, Brent.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I just listened to you on the radio, and you were talking about some friends putting insulation down in the basement, and it had water behind it.
Yeah.
I'm just in the progress. I'm just about ready to put sheetrock on the walls, and it's concrete on the part that I'm doing. We had a sump pump put in last year, and I'm just getting to the basement. So I've already put the insulation in, and they put a, it's a kind of like a fiberglass. It's not fiberglass. It's kind of a, it's a coated plastic against the concrete wall. So I'm just
wondering, is it white? Is it white?
Yeah.
And look, okay. In buildings, when we do presentations, in fact, I had that same slide last week. I did a presentation for electric cooperatives last week, and that's one of my favorite slides. We call those diapers because they go on dry and come off wet. It mm-hmm. technically meets code, but there's building inspectors in Des Moines that constantly tell me, you know, they have to pass it, but yet, you know, a few weeks later, they're all out on the curb getting thrown away because what happens mm-hmm. is they're very loose, and so they have a tendency to have water drip between that diaper blanket and the concrete. Usually that type of product gets chuckles from builders and building scientists. It's the cheapest way to go and usually doesn't work. I'm not saying it's not going to work on yours, but I'm just saying in many cases it does not work. the best case scenario is to put sheet foam, like extruded foam, gray, pink, green foam against the wall, then frame it and put your fiberglass insulation. Go to buildingscience.com, Building Science Corporation, BSC, and look at their, it's all free, look at their wall sections and basement. All you've got to do is just Google basement insulation. And make sure when you look at basement insulation, it's for our climate, because we have to meet certain levels of insulation, you know, because we're in a cold climate. But those make me really, really nervous, and that's why most building scientists call them diapers.
All right, so not a good idea.
No, and I'll probably have my tires deflated by the time I get out of here today, but yeah.
Here's a question from John in Cedar Falls. Is it worth it to remove can lights in the crawl space, plug the hole shut, and replace with new LED surface mount lamps?
I think it is, mostly because it's just, you know, air movement things. I really like the surface LEDs that, at that conference, it was really funny. I asked the group, I said, how many have switched from the can lights on new homes to the newer low profile LEDs? And almost every hand went up, because instead of having that, you know, that so-called insulation contact airtight piece of metal stuck up in your attic 10 inches, you're not even penetrating into the attic, and you can have it air sealed very easily over the top of these new LEDs. They're just really slick. I mean, they've been using them in, northern Minnesota and all these places where they have real thick roofs for quite a while, and it's just finally getting to Iowa. So and the price has come way down on them. So I would.
All right, here's a question from Paul in Des Moines. My basement walls appear to be a glazed clay hollow block, not cement cinder block. What would be the best method to fasten framework to the wall if needed? I'm afraid to drill with a normal mason bit in fear of the block being too brittle.
Yeah, and I love those foundations. I think they're just beautiful because they're just a real pretty glazed block, and they're extremely strong because of the way they're made. The best thing to do is don't even attach anything to the wall. Put a bottom plate down, a treated bottom plate on the floor, and then put a plate up against the floor of the ceiling of the basement, and just frame that up with 2x4s. But put some foam up against the wall and then frame it, and you'll have a real nice warm wall. And don't even mess with it. Just treat it like it was not even there, basically, because you're exactly right, because those block have a core in them, and in some cases they may have some moisture if there's a crack on the outside of it. So if you poke a hole in it, you may end up having some moisture run in as well. So just keep it separate.
All right. Well, Bill McAnally, we are out of time.
Oh, okay. Well, hey, enjoy the rest of your Valentine's.
You too. Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert. He'll come back next month. Hopefully no more snowstorms in the month of March, but we'll see. Next month to answer your questions about your home improvement projects. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Happy Valentine's Day.